Tehran says U.S. sanctions must be removed in practice, not on paper. Tehran again dismisses any step-by-step plan to revive the nuclear deal. Israel fully closes the fishing zone in the besieged Gaza Strip in the midst of escalating tensions in the region. The coronavirus crisis in India deepens as the country breaks the global record of daily cases for the fifth straight day. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Eruz Zentefi. Good to have you with us. Iran has stressed its stance on the 2015 nuclear deal. It says all U.S. sanctions must be removed before Tehran returns to full compliance with the accord. In his weekly press briefing, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman rejected any step-by-step revival of the deal. He said the sanctions must be lifted in practice, not on paper. Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the Islamic Republic will go into compliance once it verifies the removal of the sanctions. He described the UN-endorsed Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as the highest-level treaty. Khatibzadeh, however, criticized the U.S. for not abiding by international accords. He said that Washington has shown it's not faithful even to its own written pledges. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the nuclear agreement in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran began reducing its deal-related commitments a year later.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are preparing to hold fresh talks aimed at reviving the accord in the wake of Washington's unilateral pullout in 2018. The parties ended their last and fifth round of such talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, on Tuesday. A U.S. delegation was present in the city, but Iran rejected any discussions with it. Ahead of the upcoming negotiations, Iran's lead negotiator and deputy foreign minister warned that Tehran will not allow the talks to become attritional. Abbas Araghchi also said Iran would stop the negotiations if it detects that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seeks to add new issues to those under discussion. Iran has time and again stressed that the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, can only be salvaged if the country's demands are met.
Iran says the United States must verifiably remove all sanctions that it has imposed, reimposed, and relabeled against the Islamic Republic over the past years. Tehran also stresses that it will not accept the gradual or sequential removal of the sanctions, saying they must be removed all at once. Iran says it will return to compliance with the JCPOA only after it verifies that all sanctions have been removed in practice, not on paper.
Iran's leader has previously said those demands are the country's definitive policy. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has also said the main problem between Iran and the U.S. is that Tehran cannot trust Washington. Iran began to reduce its commitments under the JCPOA a year after former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in May 2018. Earlier this month, Iran also began enriching uranium to 60% purity. All what has been taken is in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to compensate for the U.S. withdrawal. That's what Iran says, stressing that the remedial measures are reversible only after the U.S. fulfills its JCPOA obligations. Iran says its stance on the ongoing talks over the nuclear deal is clear. Now, it seems that it's up to the Biden administration on whether to use the Vienna talks as an opportunity to comply with the JCPOA or continue the maximum pressure campaign launched by its predecessor, a campaign that many White House officials have already described as a failed policy.
Iran's top diplomat says that Iran and Iraq will stand together. He was holding talks with his Iraqi counterpart in capital Baghdad. Mohammad Javad Zarif says the two countries have good ties in economic and other areas. He said that Baghdad holds a pivotal role in the region. The Iraqi foreign minister, Fouad Hussein, said that his country is seeking to expand ties with regional countries based on common interests. Zarif also paid a visit to the site where senior Iranian commander General Soleimani and top Iraqi official al-Muhandis were assassinated in a U.S.'s track last year. The top Iran diplomat traveled to Baghdad today after visiting Doha as part of his regional tour. He held talks with the Qatari emir and foreign minister and discussed bilateral relations and holding regional and extra-regional negotiations. The Iranian army has unveiled a series of new military achievements, including advanced drone systems. Taha and Tiam are the most important systems to improve the efficacy of local drones. Human Abadi has attended a ceremony there.
Iranian Army's ground force unveiled several new achievements developed by the local experts. In a ceremony in Tehran and in the presence of high-ranking officials, seven new achievements were put on show. Portable radar alarms, portable laser alarms, micro-turbojet engine, Tiam-1400 surveillance system, artificial intelligence based flight system, Taha-1400 interception system, and upgraded ground-based jamming systems were the new breakthroughs showcased in this event.
What we are producing is based on the battlefield needs. The systems we are unveiling today can meet our military needs if any threat would come up. The Islamic Republic is now on the verge of self-sufficiency in building drones, and what is important for us now is the equipment mounted on the drones to improve their efficiency. Taha and Tiam systems will increase the operational range of our drones.
All these new military stuff have been developed by the Research and Self-Sufficiency Organization of the Army. The new systems make the identification, surveillance, and destruction of aerial and ground targets easier.
Today, the drones are a new component of armed conflicts. The ground force of Iran's army has realized that the future threats are totally different from the past ones. Therefore, it has built UAVs, which can fly at high altitudes and can carry a great amount of ammo.
Tiam 1400 has the ability to detect various types of air surveillance radar signals and transmit the received signals to disrupt them. Taha 1400 is another system that uses antennas to cover a wide area of operation and maintains the flight safety of various drones in the enemy areas.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are solely for defense purposes, and that the Islamic Republic will never negotiate over its defense capabilities. Uman Abadi, Tehran.
Now, scuffles have broken up between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds amid tensions over restrictions on Ramadan gatherings. Clashes erupted when Israeli forces waded into protesters raising the Palestinian flag. They detained several of the ralliers. Israel has tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Jerusalem Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan, including a crackdown on protests against the Kurds. More than 100 Palestinians have been injured during the clashes. Anger has also spread to other areas, sparking protests in the occupied West Bank. Mona Kendall says that the Israeli forces are angry over the Palestinians' resistance against the imposed Ramadan restrictions.
Israeli forces withdraw from the Damascus gate that's known in Arabic as Bab al-Amud in central Jerusalem, Al-Quds, after having closing it since the start of the holy month of Ramadan. Palestinians removed the iron barricades and celebrated. Hundreds of Palestinians rushed to Bab al-Amud area, known as the Damascus gate. It's one of the gates around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they lifted the Palestinian flag, and they were chanting that Jerusalem will always be the capital of Palestine. It's an Arabian city, it's a Palestinian. This has angered the Israeli forces there. Less than 1 hour after they left the Bab al-Amud area, the Israeli soldiers returned back, but with throwing two gas canisters, attacking the Palestinians and assaulting them. A number of people were wounded last night, and others were arrested, and the clashes continued for several hours.
Tel Aviv has fully closed the fishing zone in the Gaza Strip amid escalating tensions in the region. Israeli authorities said the total closure was in response to rocket attacks from the already blockaded enclave. That after the Israeli army said that five rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel overnight. Tel Aviv has set a fishing zone for the coastal enclave at 20 nautical miles. However, the regime has reduced it in recent years. In the past days, the tensions have flared up due to regime's Ramadan restrictions in Jerusalem Olympics. Now, in other news, India has been breaking the global record of daily COVID cases in the past several days. Hospitals in major cities are overwhelmed with patients. Both the public and government officials have been blamed for the spike. I've discussed the situation on the ground with our guests in our news review program. Time now for the news review section. India has broken the global record of daily coronavirus infections for the fifth straight day as it's registered nearly 353,000 new cases. Total number of COVID infections has breached the green milestone of 17.3 million. India has also registered its highest daily record of fatalities with over 2,800 new deaths. Several countries have pledged to send medical aid to help India tackle the crisis, hoarding oxygen and vital medicine in homes is worsening the situation, and that's while hospitals are overwhelmed with patients in major cities and many facing a shortage of oxygen supplies and beds. Officials blame the spike on public reluctance to observe social distancing and other health protocols. Now, to get a better picture of what's really going on in India, we have a couple of guests from India. We have our correspondent, Munawar Zaman, in New Delhi. Also, we're joined by Yogesh Jain, public health physician and co-founder of People's Health Support Group, who's joining us from Bilaspur. Good to have both of you on the show. Let's go to New Delhi to Munawar. Munawar, so what's really going on there in India? Government is saying that the people are not wearing masks and people are blaming the government. You know, we have oxygen shortages and serious ones. So what's going on the ground there?
Of course, I know very well, and everybody knows that when the pandemic was retreating in the month of October 2020, we remember, people started taking things easily. So did the government. The government started being overconfident. They believed that we have overcome the situation, and they threw out open markets, they opened their economic sectors as well, and they also announced that now we have rolled out the vaccination programs, we are also exporting the vaccination. We have made a tremendous progress in addressing the crisis of the coronavirus, but they underestimated everything. They didn't anticipate the second wave is going to be disaster for the country. Because you already know that India has a huge, massive geographical country, has also the second most population in the world. At the same time, when you have huge population, your healthcare system is ailing. You don't have healthcare structure, not only on the urban areas, but we're talking about rural areas as well. Our healthcare system here in India is so dismal because the expenditure or the overall expenditure on the health system is less than 2% of GDP. Just imagine the fact that you are addressing a health crisis for a population of more than 1.3 billion. How would you address such a crisis? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems that the administration didn't learn lessons from the developed nations such as Italy, the United Kingdom, and other countries that were handling the crisis. They were in an overconfident mode. At the same time, the problem that right now the country is facing is the acute shortage of oxygen, the acute shortage of beds, because you don't have spaces in the hospitals. I mean, if we see what is happening outside the hospitals in India, it is absolutely heart-wrenching. It's heartbreaking to see people begging for the lives of their loved ones. Please give us the oxygen. Please give us the beds. I mean, the situation is so alarming that you don't feel like going to the hospitals. You break down. I mean, your conscience tear apart. I mean, you see what's happening with the people, their relatives, the near ones and dear ones. Mm-hmm. Back to you.
Okay, now let me ask about Dr. Jain. So what's the problem? You know, is it public awareness? Is it mismanagement on the part of government? Because this has been more than a year since the world has been hit by coronavirus. So oxygen has always been a vital supply. So why should we be facing such serious problems in India?
So I think I would score it in one word, the lack of preparedness to handle crises, and in this case a pandemic, defining feature of the entire world's situation, and very much with India too, whether and preparing for an oxygen need of the nature that we have at the moment is part of that lack of preparedness that we have had. That it is also doing a surveillance for the number of new cases that emerge every week, that gives you a warning for the next episode, for the next weeks, or you know, just shutting off of care systems, not being prepared, you know, just not only being prepared for a routine number of patients, but also a surge is something that our systems have not actually matured enough to do this, and that's, we are facing the consequences of this, and I'm really worried for rural India, where when the surge really hits, after it has hit the cities of India, what will be the consequence for them?
Exactly, and we're getting this Indian version of the virus, which is much more, you know, fatal. So, doctor, it's been more than 14, 15 months. I wonder why India should not be prepared for that. So, what's the way out? Can India handle this on its own, or it does need international contribution? What's the way out?
So the way out at the moment is that we have to change our strategy to a mitigation strategy at the moment, not go into the containment or control strategy that we started with. And at this moment, our priority should be to prevent deaths from happening, and those who can, who need to get care of a differential care, oxygen-based care for the ones who are sick, and the ones who are not sick, we monitor them at home level. That has to be streamlined, and you know, forget about now testing too much or containing the disease.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Munawar Zaman, our correspondent, joined us from New Delhi. And we also had Yoga Shane, public health physician and co-founder of People's Health Support Group from Bilaspur, India, with his contribution. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Keeping the Holy Quran in mind. You, youth and teenagers who are learning the Holy Quran, know that you're creating a permanent reserve in yourselves to contemplate on. This is invaluable. When you are younger, you may not understand the deep meanings or comprehend the deep knowledge in the verses of the Holy Quran. You may only obtain little knowledge from it. But as your level of knowledge improves and your wisdom advances, you will benefit from the verses residing in your memory. Keeping the Holy Quran in mind is a great blessing. There's a difference between someone who looks for a subject in the Holy Quran over and over to find out if there are verses related to that subject and someone who knows the verses by heart and can obtain and understand whatever knowledge is needed from the Holy Quran. Establishing bonds with the Holy Quran during childhood until youth is a great gift.
حلاوة الإيمان لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان رمضان ليتك دوما قريب.
The worst pain. Brothers, let's not ignore. The worst divine torment for a nation is to become ignorant. The worst pain for society is ignorance. Let's not be ignorant and forget God. We must remember God with our hearts and souls in every decision making, every movement, every work, be it administrative, political, military or management, and every moment when assigning a budget, making law or passing judgment, and in every stage. We must work for God. That way, society will move forward. When performing congregational prayers, your prayers need to be with attention to and with humility before God. When observing itikaf, when fasting, when gathering for a religious ceremony, it needs to be with utmost attention to God and with sincerity. These are keys to success. If these are missing, fate will be what you know happened to someone. In the beginning of the revolution, some were very enthusiastic and excited, but their religious thoughts were unfortunately not deeply rooted.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
from drones to missiles. Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that showed its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials, because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies, such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, it's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it, spending more money than they already spend on the military. And right now, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud. Tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are holding talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, trying to salvage the accord. The 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been at crisis ever since the United States left the pact unilaterally in 2018 and imposed sanctions against Iran. While Tehran's precondition for returning to compliance is removal of all U.S. sanctions, Washington has so far refrained from doing so. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. Current U.S. officials and sources close to American and European negotiators have now been saying that the U.S. is dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, and intends to remove only the former. The presence of numerous Iranian names on the United States' specially designated nationals and blocked persons list even if apparently unimportant individuals, would also sharply restrict the ceiling for Iran's benefits from the JCPOA. Iran wants these names to also be removed. Iran, meanwhile, is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation, or most recently, the negotiations to revive it. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. The main sanctions were imposed on Iran's oil and banking sectors. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the nuclear accord.
Well, certainly there are sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration separate from the JCPOA that were designed to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to get back into the deal. But the Biden administration had time before it came into the White House, and now it's been 3 months. They have had the time to figure out how to lift those sanctions that were not related to the JCPOA.
During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA. Trump reimposed a series of expansive sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the deal, this time not under the pretext of concerns about Iran's nuclear program, which the JCPOA had already addressed, but under new labels, for instance, so-called sponsorship for terrorism. However, Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitments under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed.
Certainly, if there are remaining sanctions that are having an impact on the Iranian bank, for example, that makes it hard to have transactions with not only the U.S., but countries all over the world, that is problematic. If there continue to be sanctions that make other companies in countries outside the U.S. Worried about doing business with Iran because they continue to be afraid that they will be sanctioned by the United States, that is problematic. And so the U.S. really has to lift all of these sanctions because they are interconnected.
Iran is articulating what should happen in order for the deal to be revived in its original form. By refusing to listen, the United States and Europe are only making it more difficult for the prospect to materialize.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it will force Israel to free Palestinian prisoners. Senior Hamas official Khaled Mash'al said the issue of Palestinian prisoners is a top priority for all Palestinians. Mash'al said Hamas is keen on conveying the prisoners' message to the international community. He underlined the fact that Israel will not release Palestinian prisoners except through resistance by Palestinians, and that negotiations are not the way forward. The comments came as Palestinians just marked the Prisoners' Day. On April 17th of each year, Palestinians expressed their loyalty to those imprisoned by the regime and as a reminder of their legitimate struggle for freedom. An estimated 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails, many for simply challenging Israel's occupation. They include 41 women and 140 children below 18 years. Since the beginning of 2021, Israeli authorities have arrested nearly 1,400 Palestinians. Some estimates have put the number of Palestinians to have been jailed at over 1 million.
Well, on the 22nd November 1974, the United Nations General Assembly recognized the right of Palestinian people to self-determination, national independence, and sovereignty of Palestine. And these jailings of the people of Palestine are in complete contradiction to the UN General Assembly resolution. The Palestinians have a right to resist, they have a right for their homeland, and what we've seen is this systematic jailing of Palestinians. Now, whether the resistance is through the PLO, the PFLP, Hamas, the authority, or individual Palestinians is irrelevant. The relevance is that this is a criminalization, not just of a community, but of a whole nation. The figure of 1 million is shocking when we bear in mind that the population of Palestine currently is estimated at 5 million. That means that 20% of the entire population of a nation has been jailed at one particular time. And this figure in itself is shocking. It's a shocking figure, and it's something that should be rejected, and Palestinian people need to be supported in their legal battle and in their right to a homeland.
The Palestinian Prisoners' Day comes as nearly 550 inmates suffer from various diseases and require close monitoring and health care. At least 10 inmates suffer from cancer of varying degrees, including Fuad al-Shubaki, 82, the oldest of the prisoners. So far, 368 jailed Palestinians have been infected with the coronavirus. Some Palestinians have spent 40 years in captivity, with 543 sentenced to several life sentences. That brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime continues with its violation of Palestinian human rights.
Palestinians have suffered human rights abuses for decades and decades now. It will only stop when Palestinians have the right to return, when Palestinians have their homeland, and when they can legally control their own destiny. At the moment, Palestinians have very few rights, and this is part of the problem that they've been facing for many years now.
But Tel Aviv's violation of rights does not suffice to that. The regime has kept nearly 3 million Gazans under a tight blockade since 2007. As long as the coronavirus pandemic is concerned, the Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for healthcare workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic. In the occupied West Bank, the regime continues with its other violations, including settlement expansions. But why isn't the international community able to put an end to the Israeli crimes?
Well, the situation in terms of Israel-Palestine is part of a global situation. There are vested interests on both sides, and clearly the power resides against the Palestinians. There are many national organizations, international organizations, and nations who are supporting the Palestinian rights, and they should continue to do so until Palestinians get what they deserve under the UN Convention.
Israel has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since day one of its installment in the region by its Western creators. Tel Aviv enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular. No matter which party's candidate wins the race for the White House in U.S. presidential elections, there is an unwritten tradition in the U.S. foreign policy which regards the Israeli regime as a sacrosanct. In line with that tradition, each and every meaningful effort to call Tel Aviv to account at the UN Security Council over its crimes has been aborted by the U.S. that holds veto power at the world body.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I feel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I did say that it's divided into different parts. Part one, which alhamdulillah we have now finished, explaining and sharing some valuable points about it, was in regards to how one deals with himself, with herself, our relationship with ourselves. In our lives that we have, how do we cater to our own needs and requirements? Entering into part two is how do we deal with other fellow human beings, our relationship with other human beings. What you are going to receive in this dunya and also in akhirah. There are a lot of things that we know as far as acts of worship are concerned that have dunyawi effects and some that have ukhrawi effects. But something like this, where we can see that there's such a strong emphasis on it having dunyawi and ukhrawi effects, especially when it comes to your life and how long you live. If a person was to observe kin and communicate and connect with those who are related to him or her, especially those who have cut their ties with you. Because there's no merit, pretty much, there's no merit in you continuing to communicate with someone who you're already communicating with and you don't have a problem with. The merits, of course there is a merit in that, obviously, but the virtue, you know, the nobility, the merits, the extra reward is going to be when you are going to be communicating and reconnecting back with someone who has severed their ties with you. Silatul Rahim, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Silatul Rahim wa husnul jiwar يَعْمُرَانِ الْدِيَارِ وَيَزِيدَانِ فِي الْأَعْمَارِ. It will, you know, build your houses, you know, It will preserve your houses and it will increase in your lives. Silatul Rahim, observing kin and also being a good neighbor. What about all these bad things that we've spoken about in regards to someone who doesn't connect with their relatives, who cuts ties with their relatives, for whatever reason it may be? Oh, I don't know him. Oh, she said this to me. Oh, he didn't invite me. Oh, you know, my father had a problem with his father. My uncle did this to us. My auntie did that to us. You know, we weren't invited to the wedding. All these kind of excuses, you know, that we usually hear happen. Here, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, قَطِيعَةُ الرَّحِمِ تَحْجُبُ الدُّعَاءِ. If you cut your ties with your kin, your dua will be blocked. Your dua will not be heard.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
إِذَا قَطِعُ الْأَرْحَامِ. Another hadith from the Holy Prophet. If you cut your ties with your relatives, جُعِلَتِ الْأَمْوَالِ فِي أَيْدِ الْأَشْرَارِ. Your money or the wealth that's around you will be given into the hands of the evil. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he said that among the dhunub, among the sins, and تُعَجِّلُ الْفِنَاءَ قَطِيعَةُ الرَّحِيمِ, that will hasten in your death, that will hasten in your death, is by severing ties with your kin. Another hadith, يَكُونُ أَجَلُهُ, and we already mentioned this, that your life will be 33 years longer, and then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will cut it down because you were قَاطِعُ الرَّحِيمِ, he will cut it down to ثَلَاثَ سِنِينَ, to 3 years. Now, what is the reason why people, you know, sever ties and don't, you know, communicate with their relatives or, you know, cut off any kind of relationship with their kin? It could be dunyawi related matters. You know, he didn't invite me, or she didn't do this to me, or they didn't sell him to me, or when the inheritance was being distributed, I didn't get this part. Dunyawi things coming down to hirs, coming down to greed, or it's just a lack of akhlaq, lack of tolerance, lack of simple adab, lack of modesty and chastity when it does come to revering and respecting your elders. You know, your uncle said that to you, so what? Your auntie said that to you, so what? You know, they were angry at the time. They don't have that level of iman that you do. Why take yourself to their level? Why bring yourself down? Why allow yourself to commit a major sin by cutting your ties with your relatives. Okay, you want to teach them a lesson, or you want to do this, or you want to do that? Yes, but there are certain ways. Iyakum washuh, beautiful hadith, says, be careful of greed. فَإِنُّهُ دَعَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ حَتَّى سَفَكُوا دِمَاءُهُمْ وَدَعَاهُمْ حَتَّى قَطَعُوا أَرْحَامَهُمْ. In Kitab al-Khisal, this hadith pretty much says that, you know, this very simple greed, simple act of greed will lead not only to shedding of blood, but also to cutting of ties. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahlai. Just a couple of weeks ago, we covered the 10-year war anniversary of the war on Syria. Now it's time to cover another brutal U.S.-backed war, and that is the war on Yemen. It is now 6 years old. This is what Yemen's economy looked like before the war. From the year 2000, we took a look up until the year 2018. As you can see, the economy was actually not doing that bad. It had a GDP growth of between 6 to 8%. But you can see the dip there. That is when the war broke out, roughly around the year 2014, and it went all the way down to minus 28%. Pretty bad. I mean, this actually is a brutal war. Bombs are doing the killing on both the civilians and the economy. But the country itself actually, before the war began, was not doing well. It was a poor country. Living on less than $2 a day accounted for 45% of the population, 33% living on less than $1 a day. So you can see that this country was affected deeply by poverty. Okay, it is no surprise then that this kind of devastation, the war that the country has been inflicted on the country, well, there are many aspects of the economy that have grinded to a halt as a result. One common denominator that reflects the dire straits of the economy is the collapse of the Yemeni rial, the focus of our next report.